Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported, nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now. You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show where we tell the story behind your favorite Asian dishes. I'm Linda Liu, and on the line is my co-host in Hong Kong, Iris Van Kerkhove.
Hello from Hong Kong. I'm really happy today because it's my last day of work before I leave for vacation, and I'm going to be in the studio in person with you very soon, Linda.
Yes. So we'll have the very rare opportunity to pre-record an episode together here in the studio next week. Super exciting. But today we are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, Iris and I dig deep on a dish or an aspect of Asian cuisine, and we interview experts on the topic.
So before we start today's interview, Linda and I like to kick off the episode with a question for each other. What's the best thing you ate in the past week?
Yeah, so I had this amazing egg and cheese bagel sandwich from this neighborhood joint called Frankel's Delicatessen, right by McCarran Park in Greenpoint. / Williamsburg, and the weather here in New York has just been so erratic, like in the 50s or 60s one day and then raining, and then like today it was like in the 90s and humid, but this was just like so perfect for a sad, gloomy, rainy day. What about you, Iris? What have you been eating?
So staff meal at work is often the best food I eat all week. I try to refrain from mentioning it when we do the segment.
But it's true.
But this week I had to mention it because they made one of my favorite, all-time favorite dishes, and that is eggplant and minced pork. I know it's not the most, you know, original
lamb
one, but it's a dish that's from Sichuan originally, and it's popular in American Chinese cuisine, but also very popular in Hong Kong, though we usually do a non-spicy version because there really isn't much heat in Cantonese cuisine. But yeah, they do a really good one, so I enjoyed it.
Oh, yum.
So instead of focusing on a specific food today, we're going to be examining Korean food in America and how it left K-Town into mainstream American cuisine, and why it perhaps took longer to receive the same attention other international cuisines have received in the West.
Yeah, and to talk about this subject is Chul Kim. He's the owner of the popular Little Dokebi and Dokebi Bar and Grill restaurants, as well as a kimchi factory in Brooklyn. So Chul was born in Seoul, Korea, and he grew up here in New York City in Queens. After college, Chul spent 10 years in banking, decided that life was too short and needed to pursue his dreams. And inspired by the downtown restaurant bar scenes and also being motivated by his mother, Chul decided to bring Korean food out of K-Town and introduce it to a broader audience. So not only is he going to talk about Korean cuisine in America, but he'll also touch on his journey into the business and his thoughts on the current state of the restaurant industry. Welcome to the show, Chul.
Hi.
So tell us in a little bit more detail, how did you end up where you are now?
Okay, well, it's a bit of a long journey, but right after I left banking, I was in a bit of a quandary about what to do with myself. Mm-hmm. My options were, do I become a fashion designer or do I open a restaurant?
They're kind of different.
Yeah, it's quite different.
And also from banking, like, how did you even arrive at those two?
Yeah, I was never the, you know, quintessential banker. Mm-hmm. I always felt a little out of place in banking. Mm-hmm. What I did in banking was trading, so it was okay. Completely merit-based.
All right.
But when I left, those are the two things my interests were in, and... Mm-hmm. I decided to go into the restaurant business because I thought the fashion industry was too risky.
Okay. So there's your, like, you know, financial, like, banking background, mm-hmm. choosing a safer bet. But it's still extremely creative, so it seems like...
Yeah, it is creative. And it's tough. I think the odds are stacked against you.
Yeah. And you mentioned that, you, you know, on an earlier call that you worked in your brother's fish market. What was that about?
Yeah, at one point after leaving banking and before I'd embarked on the restaurant business, I was in this, research stage.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to learn about the different kinds of food. My brother had purchased a building in Canarsie, which had a fish market in it.
Wow.
So he started running that, but I think running a fish market is quite difficult. So at one point he asked me to give him a hand.
Mm-hmm.
I went down there and just kind of full-on jumped in, and I think I was down there for almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
The market started doing well, but and I also learned a ton about fish.
Yeah, literally getting your hands wet.
Yeah, and smelly.
Yeah. So, like, was that your first exposure into the food industry? Did you have any idea when you were younger that you would fall into this line of work?
No. it was not something that remotely occurred to me.
Yeah, and how did... like your mom think about your career changes?
It was weird. I mean, she always encouraged me to do what I wanted to do. But she did like the job that I had. she was quite proud of me.
Yeah.
And I think when I decided I was going to give it all up, she was a little bit concerned about my future.
Got it.
And so was I, to be honest.
As all Asian parents do. It's exactly. A similar thought. And, so did you grow up eating her food? Did she cook for you?
Oh, yeah. I think 6 out of 7 dinners a week were, you know, it was Korean food that she had cooked.
Mm-hmm.
My mom actually studied home ec and history at Seoul University.
Uh-huh.
And she was an amazing cook. Very subtle flavors without overpowering all the dishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot from her.
Yeah. So, outside of your mother, who have, like, been your other food inspirations, or how did you come up with the idea of, like, bringing Korean food out of K-Town?
You know, I think I was basically, this is the banker in me coming out again.
Mm-hmm.
I was looking to minimize risk, and I wanted to do something where I thought I might have an opening in the market where, you know, there was a need and nobody was jumping in to fill it. There were, at that point, one or two restaurants that were slightly outside of Koreatown.
Mm-hmm. And what year was that?
This was 2003, 2002, like mm-hmm. right around there when I really started thinking about it. There was a restaurant called Doksuni. This girl named Jenny ran that place. And she had been open almost 7 or 8 years at that point, I think. I had a tremendous amount of respect for her because mm-hmm. she kind of forged a new trail in an area where she probably had to educate the whole neighborhood to her food.
Yeah.
So I guess she may have been an inspiration for me to feel like, hey, you know, I might be able to do this as well.
Yeah. And so what was her neighborhood? And now, like, what is your neighborhood?
She was on the Lower East Side.
Okay.
And she opened when that neighborhood was also hadn't quite gentrified yet.
Mm-hmm.
I just growing up in New York City, I watched the gentrification of Soho, and I watched it spread east. And when mm-hmm. it hit the water, I realized it was going to cross the bridge.
Right.
And I saw the L train as a viable avenue where I think along the L train, the neighborhoods were going to slowly gentrify.
Mm-hmm.
It was still a little bit rough, but I think the writing was on the wall that right around the turn of the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
It looked like Williamsburg was going to start becoming, more gentrified.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody could have foreseen what it has kind of turned into at this point.
So, yeah, how rapid it has been. And
yeah, it's been incredible. So,
so how do you think the landscape towards kind of Korean restaurants have been different now in this case? Like,
yeah, with Koreans came to the United States predominantly in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people came a little bit earlier, but in the 70s, I think U.S. immigration allowed a lot of Koreans in.
Okay.
And I think that's when the Koreatown started really kind of, coming to life, both in Flushing, parts of northern New Jersey, Manhattan, and also in L.A. And Koreans had, I know Koreans that have been in this country 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
Who still don't speak English very well.
Right.
And it's because they kind of stay in this close-knit community, like, in their own little neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. You think more so than other ethnic groups?
I think a lot of Asians tend to do this.
Yeah.
But with Koreans, I think it was so easy because there were so many of them that had, like, gathered together in an area that they were able to kind of form their own ecology.
Right, like all at once, too.
Yeah, and they Koreans also are, quite religious at times. You meet a lot of religious yeah. Koreans. And I think that the church served as a gathering place, which, allowed a lot of Koreans to get, come together and meet and have social, activities together.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so how did you decide to open your first restaurant off Bedford in Williamsburg? What was, the decision behind that?
Okay, so when I first started coming to Williamsburg, it was just around 2001, 2002, just to come and visit. I had a couple of friends that were artists that were living here.
Okay.
You
were living in the city?
Yeah,
okay.
I was in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, Williamsburg, to me, consisted of three blocks. Those are the only three safe blocks, and then venturing past that was a little bit, it was shady.
Mm-hmm.
Once I got here and started looking for a restaurant space,
mm-hmm.
That was a couple years later, and Bedford Avenue had already kind of stretched itself a few more blocks. And it started looking like it was going to become the main thoroughfare for the neighborhood.
Yeah.
With the subway on it and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of realized it was sort of like looking at either Soho or the Village.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking that, I don't want to be that restaurant that's on St. Mark's Place.
Oh,
yeah.
Good point.
Yeah, I want to be on a side street,
uh-huh.
Where people kind of find you and, come to you. So I passed up several affordable spaces on Bedford Avenue and took a much larger space on Grand Street, which was about seven or eight blocks away.
Mm-hmm. So. Oh, that's really interesting. And you built your restaurants by hand? Is that what's the case there?
Yeah, so I've been accused of being a little OCD. My favorite places all had a lot of character. My favorite places mm-hmm. to go out to, like Casimir in the city. I find when the owners or the proprietors really get involved in, mm-hmm. In the decoration and the actual physical building of a place,
yeah,
the places take on some soul, like some there's a lot more meaning to like mm-hmm. what they're doing there than a bunch of store-bought,
right, the aura is different.
Exactly.
And I can speak from experience here, living right by Little Dokebi, and I go there a lot, and yeah, the aura is different. It's clear that nothing is standardized.
No.
I guess. Does that make things difficult for you?
Yeah, it does. Little Dukhevi has a dining area, which is about 400 square feet. That took me 9 months to build.
Okay.
At one point, I went upstate and chainsawed a barn down to get wood.
Whoa.
To use for wall cladding.
Oh.
So.
Cool. You could start like a blog about that.
Oh, man. I wish I knew what a blog was.
So tell us, what does Dukhevi mean?
Dukhevi is it's a proper name of a mythical Korean creature. He's kind of a devilish kind of character. I named that place Dukhevi because when I was a little kid, my mom said I got up on my feet at 10 months and never went back down on my mm-hmm. all fours. And then the thing that clenched this nickname for me was my first set of teeth that came in were my fangs.
Whoa.
So my mom was like, oh, it's the little devil. So.
Oh, that's nice. She nicknamed kind of like Dukhevi. A tribute to mom, too.
It was, yeah. By the way, Little Dukhevi, I started construction on the place right after my mother passed away.
Oh, wow.
That's why I decided to kind of spend a long time building it and make it kind of special.
Process.
Yeah.
That's really cool. That's so special. We're going to take a really quick break, and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cooking machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hi, I'm Kate Black, host of Magnifico Radio and Heritage Radio Network, the weekly podcast featuring conversations in ethical fashion, clean beauty, and sustainable living. Tune in on Mondays at 1 o'clock when I sit down with designers, makers, and leaders at the forefront of sustainability. Support my show and all of the Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to become a member today.
Hi, you're listening to Feast Meets West, and we're here with Chul Kim. So how did you decide on, you know, what you have on your menus at your restaurants?
The first thing I did was I tried to put on the menu stuff I liked, all the dishes that I liked. They also happen to be probably the more popular dishes in, you know, Korean restaurants, the barbecue stuff. Bibimbap, which is pretty much a staple for almost every Korean restaurant, and a lot of the soups and stews. Those were the things that I grew up eating that my mom would always make. You know, earlier you asked me, you know, about my inspirations for this thing. I will say that when I first got involved in, you know, building the restaurant and getting into the business, I wasn't very well educated on food. It was a learning experience right from the beginning. And I think I was lucky enough to have some contemporaries in the neighborhood that were concentrating on farm to table. And they were using lots of organic stuff. And that wasn't something I really gave a whole lot of thought to back then. But as I frequented their restaurants, like Diner, there was a chef named Caroline there. I really started kind of researching and learning more about food and, you know, the, I guess the, how food ends up on your table.
Yeah.
And the more I started learning about that, the more concerned I became about, you know, what we're eating. And at that point, I kind of, you know, made a decision that I was going to try to get the most, you know, the healthiest ingredients I could find. And the funny thing is, when I started looking into sourcing Korean ingredients, it was very difficult to find. A lot of very common vegetables that Koreans are using on a daily basis, it was almost impossible to find them organic.
Wow.
Yeah, it got to the point at one point I literally contracted farms to grow a lot of stuff for us.
Okay.
And that, you know, we had some triumphs and lots of defeats there. Some of these farmers were just learning how to grow some of these vegetables.
Wow.
So we didn't have the best yield. So it got quite expensive.
That's such a, interesting difference. And it just sounds like 2005 wasn't so long ago, and yet you had all these, you were kind of like the first to do a lot of these things.
I think when it comes to Korean food, I think I may have, I'm probably definitely not the first, right? I think
but for Williamsburg or Greenpoint,
For people in New York, I think it was a first. And then the other things that ended up on my menu were things that just people were demanding from me. They're like, how could you not have this on your menu?
Oh, okay. So is that stuff like Korean fried chicken or the tacos? I guess those are kind of more modern variations of Korean cuisine, right?
Yeah. Korean fried chicken, I kind of discovered on my own. I went and ate it. I was like, I didn't know fried chicken could be this good.
Yeah, yeah.
So I came back and I spent about 3 months working on a recipe. And finally nailed one down and started making it.
That's awesome. So do you get inspired by like traveling, or do you go to the different K-towns? Like, how do you keep in touch?
I don't.
Oh, okay.
I don't go to other Korean restaurants very often. I kind of enjoy doing things in a vacuum. I feel like in a way that it kind of insulates me from being influenced or like following what other people are doing.
Yeah.
I've kind of always just kind of done what made sense to me. So, and I think it's, you know, I think it's served me well. The things that I do, I think, you know, they're very logical to me, and they oftentimes come very natural to me. So I think when you do something that someone else is doing, and you don't quite have the same spirit or feeling about it, or or even the knowledge of it, I think you can kind of like, you're not really in tune with what you're doing.
Right.
I think that's probably not the best way to go.
Oh, got it. Yeah. So you ensure your like passion is there every time.
Yeah. If I don't feel decisions. If it's not something that I feel right about, then you know I don't even really look into it.
Yeah. So I noticed like one thing that's special about your restaurants is you don't do food PR.
No, right. PR is another thing that I never quite understood. I think the first time I was approached by somebody, they told me that they were going to promote my place, and they asked me for some money, and I was like, I cannot possibly afford that. I could barely pay my rent right now. And they told me that it would help in paying the rent. I think, I don't know, for some reason I didn't buy into it. I ended up, in the first few years were very lean. Williamsburg wasn't that busy. It wasn't that crowded. So, you know, we were kind of just like a small community of people. And when I say small community of people, I mean kind of the gentrifying crowd that came in. There were people, plenty of people there. Most of them weren't very open to the idea of eating Korean food, although we did make a lot of converts along the way.
Awesome. So how do you, how do you grow your business?
Yeah, the first PR I ever did was realizing that we weren't going to sell all the food we bought. So I walked into the kitchen and I was like, hey, you know, pack up 50 lunches for me.
Wow.
And I literally walked around with bags of lunches, walked around the neighborhood with a menu and bags of lunches and gave them away to other stores and, you know, people who were working and living in the area. That was the first PR I did. And in the same way that I think you want to grow your food organically, I think sometimes growing your business that way is also a much healthier way to sustain a business. I think our business grew by word of mouth. It was local people. we still have people who came in on the first day that we opened that are still coming in on a regular basis. Those customers tend to be more loyal. You have to become friends with them. And when you go out, if you choose to go somewhere, you tend to go places where you know you're going to be, with like-minded people and, have same interests.
You want to enjoy yourself.
Yeah, and I think with, even in this business, I think, it works the same way. You go to Williamsburg, now it's a bit different, but back then you were in Williamsburg and, I liked where I was.
Right.
I liked the people here, I actually loved it here. So. Mm-hmm. And having those people as customers and catering to them was a joy. Not often profitable, but it was definitely fun. Mm-hmm. So, that's how we grew. And I think
so. That's your recommended strategy for new restaurants, or not for everyone?
I think that's a great strategy for new restaurants. I think there are other business models where, some restaurants won't open unless there's a certain amount of foot traffic. It's more commercial that way.
Got it.
I actually have a strategy that I would advocate.
Okay.
I think, as neighborhoods gentrify, I think these neighborhoods need infrastructure. Mm-hmm. There are people moving in, and there aren't enough restaurants, there aren't enough stores to,
kind of keep them engaged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I think the best way to open a restaurant is, not to go into an already gentrified neighborhood where you're going to be paying astronomical rent.
Mm-hmm.
I think you should look for areas that are look like they're, burgeoning, and find a nice, retail space.
Mm-hmm.
Put some love into building it, and then, create good food and do good food, and you're going to develop a really good following. Years later, you'll be paying very little rent, and you'll have a good customer base as other people keep moving in. And
yeah.
I think that's a great strategy for longevity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because how long have you had your restaurants now?
Yeah, Dokebi is 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've got another 8 years left on the lease. So. Mm-hmm. And that's been already renegotiated, but...
Oh, nice.
I think there are people paying three times as much as I am for the same size space, and I can't imagine doing that. It's it must be, daily, all you must be thinking is, I have to come up with the money for rent.
Right.
And, that's an awful lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And tell us about your kimchi factory.
Ah, okay. So... we always made the kimchi in the basement of Dokebi.
Okay.
As little Dokebi was, in construction, I started realizing if little Dokebi does well, there's no way we're going to be able to make enough kimchi and banchan, which are the side dishes that come with a lot of Korean food.
Yeah.
There's no way we're going to be able to supply both restaurants out of Dokebi. And little Dokebi is so small that you could pivot on 1 foot in the kitchen and get to every appliance in the kitchen.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize how small that kitchen was.
Yeah. Our office is a little loft space where you can peek your head through a hole on the bottom, and there's a printer and a computer in there.
Nice.
So you have to climb up a ladder and stand on the
ladder. Oh, I think I've seen that. And I was like, that's a cute little treehouse inside of the restaurant.
Yeah.
So that's your office.
That's the office.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Secrets out.
Yeah. So anyway, I decided there was a space right near my house that was for rent, and the rent was pretty reasonable. So I went in there and negotiated a lease and built a kimchi factory inside.
Got it.
And in the front, the place was so big that I was like, what am I going to do with all this space? So in the front, I decided to just make a little Korean grocery store with the kimchi counter.
Mm-hmm.
And we just sell kimchi out of there.
Yeah.
And then that was about 3 years ago. Recently, we just started bottling the kimchi.
Okay.
We just got into Murray's Cheese, by the way.
Oh, congratulations.
So, yeah. That's,
so now you're, a supplier of kimchi to other retailers, kind of?
Yeah, we're open to doing that, but,
yeah.
I, as everything that I've done so far, I scale quite slowly.
Yeah, on purpose.
Yeah.
Got it.
I'm going to learn and, you know, do this thing for a while. We have enough capacity to, you know, handle the Maurice business.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly, and you know, slowly we're hoping to add accounts and while growing our, you know, capacity to be able mm-hmm. to make the kimchi. So.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's a smart way to go about it step by step.
Yeah.
So on your website for a little dokebi, mm-hmm. you have Greenpoint's only Korean restaurant.
Yeah, what are you going to
do?
True.
Yeah. What are you going to do when that's not the case? Like, how are you going to edit this tagline?
Well, thanks for pointing that out. I'm going to have to go back and take that off. Yeah, I think several restaurants have opened up recently. Mm-hmm. I haven't, like my earlier theory, I haven't been to any of them yet.
Okay.
I'm not sure if I'm going to go.
Sure.
yeah, it might feel uncomfortable, actually. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I'm going to have to change that tagline.
Yeah. But
I'll change it to the first Korean restaurant in Greenpoint.
Right, right. I did think about that, too.
Yeah.
So what's your hope for, you know, Korean cuisine outside of K-Town now? Like, in the neighborhood, within New York City, what's your hope for it?
Well, I'm glad people have become very open to you know, trying it and enjoying it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a pretty, you know, there's a lot of depth to Korean food. There are lots of flavors and techniques that, you know, it'll take someone a long time to really, you know, get to understand Korean food,
mm-hmm.
Which is nice because, you know, you won't get bored with it.
Right.
And they're going to be constantly, there'll be new options you can keep trying.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of interest in Korean food in America right now.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing I kind of question is that, my concern is that there isn't that much immigration of Koreans into America anymore.
Okay.
So it's really difficult to get... like hiring kitchen staff that understands Korean food is pretty difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I have a feeling what will happen to Korean food eventually is that we'll have sort of like a across the pond, you know, relationship,
like exchange program.
Yeah, where Korean chefs, you know, do come here and like, you know, show us what they can do. But I have a feeling Korean food will kind of be assimilated a little bit. As it becomes more, I think it's going to become more Americanized.
Mm-hmm.
My hope is that it doesn't get overly commercially popular. So every Korean food experience you have is at a chain store.
Okay.
I think that would be something that's not going to be great in the long run.
Mm-hmm.
For, you know, for the culinary experience of Korean food.
Right, right. So. But as long as, you know, there are experiences like your restaurants.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the range is something to consider.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, I think I'm a 1.5, you know, first 1.5 generation Korean.
Yep, fair.
And I think we were the perfect, in the perfect place to be able to introduce this food to to Americans,
right?
Because we straddled the fence and know both cultures,
mm-hmm.
And you know, just knowing one culture, I think it's very difficult to have a working knowledge of Korean food if you're too American.
Yep.
If you're too Korean, it's very difficult to know, you know, how to present it.
Mm-hmm.
So. You know, I think I don't know. I'm quite uncertain about the future of it. I know it's going to become more popular.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's going to maintain its authentic roots.
Sure.
So,
well, thanks for, you know, starting to bring the Korean food out of K-Town.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and that's it for our show today. For listeners who want to learn more about your restaurants and actually want to stay updated on your projects, how should they keep in touch?
Oh wow. Just pop into the restaurant and look for me.
All right. Yeah. Simple.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on the show and for sharing your journey with us.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
I also want to take a quick moment to talk about Heritage Radio Network Summer Drive. As you know, this show is only possible thanks to member donations. We wouldn't be able to reach you every week without the generosity of our HRN members around the world. And now is your chance to join the club. Becoming a member is super easy, and it comes with limited edition summer swag like t-shirts, drink koozies, and pins. You can sign up for a one-time donation or become a monthly sustaining member by visiting heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now.
Yes, let's keep food radio on the airwaves this summer. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.